Have you ever experienced this conversation? I have, even in the last few weeks, you've experienced some sort of conversation that goes like this. Listen, I don't have any problem with God. I don't have any problem with Jesus. Jesus and I are cool. I'm just not a church person. Anybody heard that? Anybody had one of those conversations? Maybe you've heard that conversation across the cubicle. But somebody's like, listen, I'm down with Jesus. I'm just not a church person. And if you begin to explore that conversation, what you typically find out is that they've had a bad experience with church. They've been to church. They went to church with grandmother. They went to church on Easter. They even grew up. I've met people who have grown up in great youth groups, great churches, but they get to a point where something happens. They get burnt. They get burnt out. They get overchurched. They de-church. Whatever they do, something happens, and they go, you know what? I don't have any problem with Jesus, but I got a problem with church. And the more I have this conversation, here's what I've kind of learned by just listening to those sorts of conversations, not trying to convince them to like church again, but just listening to them. Here's what I've typically have learned in this is that most people don't like church because they feel like church doesn't like them. That most people go, listen, I just don't feel like I fit in there. I don't feel like it offers me anything. I don't feel like that it's meeting me where I'm at. You know, I just feel like an outsider. I just don't feel like I belong. I just don't feel comfortable. And so they get to a place where they say, listen, I just don't like church because I've never experienced a church. I've never experienced a space or environment that feels like it likes me. And so they kind of just throw the baby out with the bathwater. They just kind of throw it out and say, well, I guess I'm just not a church person. I'm down with God. I'm good with Jesus. I have a personal relationship. I just don't see a lot of need for church. Because church doesn't seem like that it needs me. Now, one of the problems with local church, and I don't want to start 2016 off negatively, but I've been a part of a few churches, and I now lead a church, and so I feel like I'm at least able to have an opinion on this. You may disagree. But one of the problems I found with local churches is this, is that most feel like they are designed for churched people. Most churches that I've been a part of, most of them feel like they're for churched people. We know where to park. We know what the signage means. We know what sanctuary means when it has an arrow. And some people walk in and go, I don't know what any of that means. What's the fellowship hall? I know I'm supposed to go there for some reason, but I don't know what that is. We know the language. We've been justified and sanctified, and other people go, I don't have a, what do you mean justified? I watch a show called Justified. And you're going, what does that mean? And we know the songs, right? We know the sway of the music. Most of us are white, so we try to sway to the music. But we know kind of the music, and we know the flow, and we listen to it in our car, and we can take this, and we can find Philemon. In about 3 seconds, guys, it's one page. It's really easy to miss, but we know how to do that, and we don't need the Bible on the screen. We've got it on our apps, and we just know this, and we know this insider language. That's the problem I have found with most churches. And here's the real issue: is what this communicates is this. What it means to people that are not church people, and it's not intentional, okay? Nor is it explicit. It's not like we say this, but here's kind of the way it translates sometimes is this. If church is for church people, then Christianity must be for church people, which means Jesus must be for what? Church people. And again, we don't believe that. We would never say that. But when people are made to feel kind of that way, that's what they say. And it's not intentional, but it could easily turn into a reality, or at least a perceived reality, for most of the people in our community. But here, I love our church. Okay? I'm going to go on record and say it. I love our church. And one of the things that I've loved about Well House over the last 12, 14 months is this, is that we have created an environment where everyone feels welcome. Guys, I've heard it over and over and over. Can I just brag on Chris for a second? I'm going to brag on us, I guess, from Chris last week. Chris filled in for me last week. I was traveling with family. And you know what Chris told me on the phone? He said, Jason, he said, let me tell you what I love most about your church is the way they treated me before they knew I was the speaker. They said from the time I walked in to the time I wired up, he said that meant more to me than the moment from when I wired up from there on. He said everybody talks to the preacher, right? Everybody wants to talk to the guy who spoke. But he said, the way I was treated from the time that I walked in to the time I stood right here means so much. He said, your church made me feel like I had been there, part of that, welcomed me, showed me where things were. And he said, it goes beyond that. It just felt right. And I love that about us. I love that regardless of your age, I've had this conversation with some of you, especially some of you older people. I love the fact that we have people here that are in their upper years. I love that. You know, I've been to churches where they're kind of starting out of the gate and out of the box, and you look around and it's kind of one demographic, maybe two generation. I love the fact that we have young and old. I love the fact that it doesn't matter what background you come from. It doesn't matter how much Bible stuff you know. That you can walk in and it just seems like that there's at least for a moment, a level playing ground where you can kind of get your footing and see what it is that God maybe is trying to do and what direction he's trying to push you. And here's the thing. I love our church because of that. But I don't want it, I want to stay that way. Don't you? I want to make sure that 2016, we remain a place that is for everyone and it won't be easy, okay? It won't be easy. In fact, this may just be my every January 2nd, 3rd, 4th, somewhere in there. This may be my sermon every January, is that I want to make sure that we stay a place that is for everyone. It's going to require us to be intentional. It won't be easy because here's what happens. Our natural tendency as people is what? Our natural gravitational pull, if you will, is what? Inward. We tend to focus on the insider. But even the most basic of text, the one that everybody holds up at a sign, I don't know if anybody does this anymore, but used to hold up on a sign, John 3:16. Even if you're kind of sort of churched, you know this. But what does it say? It says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son. It says that he loved the world. So, okay, if Jesus didn't come for the insider, then here's the question for us starting 2016, because we've done such a phenomenal job of this in 2015. What do we got to do in order to remain that way? What do we got to do to continue to create opportunity? What do we got to do to continue to prop the door open so that everybody feels like they can come and go and feel comfortable in this space? Now, we're not the first people to ask that. We're not the first church. We're not the first culture. We're not the first city to deal with some of this natural gravitational pull of insider stuff. In fact, Acts chapter 15, church is kind of new. If you want to turn there, go ahead and grab that. Acts 15, I'm going to put everything up on the screen anyway. If you don't have a Bible, by the way, grab one off the communion table. If you're using one of those, it's going to be on page 755, so it'll make it a little easier for you to find. But the church, this movement has begun, and Jesus hasn't been gone very long. These people that we're talking about in this text today would have known Jesus. They probably would have seen Jesus in some context. Maybe they had taken fish and chips out of the basket, but they had been in context of seeing Jesus, had known Jesus. They lived in the same time as Jesus. They're not like us. They're not 2,000 years removed. It's brand new, and there's already an insider problem. And so Peter and the gang, some of Jesus' closest disciples, some of his closest friends, the leader of this movement, they've come together now and said, okay, we got to deal with this insider problem. So before we get to Acts 15, let me kind of back up. It begins really in about Acts 2. So this church, this movement that Jesus has kind of said, I'm going to set into motion, had kind of gained a little traction. About 5,000 people or so in Acts 2 came to know Jesus and embraced him. And as a result of that, the city, or really more like the region now is in uproar. The region has kind of been set ablaze because the delicate balance of power between the temple, the Jewish leaders, and Rome had already kind of been compromised a little bit. And so you've got this disturbance that now has taken place between what was already a very tense time between Jews and Romans. Now you have this third thing, this Christianity, these Jesus followers who have now started to cause some issues, not intentionally, but just an uproar, disturbance. And so there's resistance that begins to take place, not just from Rome, but inside the church. Between these former temple people, these former Jews, now these church people. And so here's what's happening. Disciples, followers of Jesus are being arrested. They're being flogged. They're being warned, hey, you guys have got to, you got to shut this down. It's not that we care that you're believing in this guy Jesus. You're causing problems for the city. You're causing issues. And so if there's an issue, then we've got issues, what Rome is saying. So you got to shut this down. And then all of a sudden, about Acts chapter 7, we see this young guy named Stephen. Stephen's on fire. He's preaching, you know, Jesus being raised. Jesus is now this symbol of hope, and he's a relational guy that wants to restore those things that are broken in your life. And they said, enough of that. So they stone Stephen. This young guy, they take him out, drag him out, and they stone him to death. And as he's being stoned, bleeding from his head, he's saying, hey, but Jesus is still in control, and he's still preaching these messages. And so after that, they said, you know what? That didn't do it. We thought that'd send the message. Now let's just go broad with this. Let's just begin persecuting everybody. Anybody you can find that claims the name of Jesus. So this mass persecution breaks out. So as a result of that, Christians, Jesus followers, begin to scatter. But they don't shut it down. As they scatter outside of Jerusalem in this area, they still take the message of Jesus with them where they're going. And this raged on for a couple of years. Then the leader of this persecution, the main guy, a guy named Saul, is on the road to Damascus to head over to this other place to kind of get some things in order there to shut down the name of Jesus in this city, is now converted. We now know him as Paul. So then Paul becomes a believer in Jesus, and then he begins to plant these churches, and the gospel, this message of Jesus, takes off. It's spreading. Lives are changing then. See, now this is why I want to talk about this morning. Because there have been a lot of good things happening in 2015. But it seems like when momentum begins to shift and things begin to go right and you begin to look around and go, hey, you know, this is okay. There's always going to be a then. Something happens. And this is what happens. There's a big controversy that happens. And this is where Acts 15, and guys, we're still dealing with this problem today. That's why I said one of the problems with the local church is what I said it was. We're still dealing with this. I believe this is one of the reasons, maybe one of the top reasons, why people walk away and say, listen, I'm okay with Jesus, I'm just not okay with church. It's the same problem they're dealing with, and here it is. It's who gets to be a part of the church? Who belongs? Who is church for? This is the problem that shows up in Acts 15, and it's the problem that I think continues to linger. It's questions like, well, how good does a person really have to be in order to fit in? I mean, how much do you need to know and what steps do you need to have taken before you're really considered an insider, before you're really a part of it? Now, you might welcome me and show me where the coffee urn is, but I want to know, how good do I have to be in order to really be a part of it? How do I move from outsider to insider? Guys, isn't that the same thing that we're still dealing with? I mean, some of you I know have church shopped and been in churches, maybe given up on church, because you never could figure out how to flip the switch from outsider to insider. You never could figure out how to be good enough. You never could figure out how to dress properly, maybe. And so we still deal with these kinds of things, and it's no different. The Jews, during this time, said, well, let's just be logical. Jesus was a Jew, right? And he fulfilled Jewish prophecy. So if he's a Jew who fulfilled Jewish prophecy, doesn't it make sense that in order to follow him, that you have to become a Jew? And so you got these Jewish people saying, listen, in order for you to be a Christian, a Jesus follower, then you got to become a Jew first. You got to be acquainted with the law. You've got to kind of follow the laws of Jewish, the Jewish system. But here's the problem. Paul, on the other hand, Paul's running around inviting everybody to the table. You a Jew? Doesn't matter. Come on. So you got him running around saying, listen, all you non-Jews, you can now be a part of, you can now fit into, you now belong. And so all these people now are flooding the church, and they didn't act right. They walked in not dressed properly. It was disruptive. And Paul says, hey, by the way, it's pretty easy to join. You believe in Jesus? You know, follow Jesus, you know, give your life to Jesus, boom, you're done, you're in. And the Jews then go, whoa, 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 whoa. It's not that easy. Now, Paul, I don't know what Jesus told you, but it's just not that easy. And here's the thing, my hunch is that if you've had a bad experience with church, my hunch is, and it probably was related to an issue or a conversation, something like this. Hey, we're glad you're here. But now, if you want to be a part of us, you're going to have to blank. Whatever that blank was, You're going to, you can't just walk in here and not pay your dues, especially dressed like that. I mean, come on now, please. Now, we want you to be here. We really like you. But we're going to need you to do and perform and be something. And here's the problem with it. We're going to get to this in a second. We expect that to be instant. We expect that to be semi-immediate. We're going to give you 3 weeks, and then we're going to move you to the regular visitor list. But when you become a regular visitor, then comes in the expectations, right? And so my hunch is that you probably went, you know what? I can't do this. Now, the flip side is this. Us church folk, us Christians, we've been around for a while. We wrestle with it from the other side. We go, but Jason, hold up. Now, you know, the Bible's full of moral code. I mean, people got to act right to a degree. I mean, we can't just throw out what Jesus says about how we're supposed to live. I mean, I get that, you know, we want to be welcoming, but come on, Jason. I mean, you can't continue to do that. I mean, there's got to be limits somewhere, right? I mean, we got to draw some kind of line in the sand, and here's what happens. I'm going to put this on the screen. In churches, grace and truth often collide or they conflict. They conflict. And so as a result of this, here's what happens. We establish boundaries. We put up walls. And again, it's not that we intentionally do this sometimes, but we begin to kind of have unwritten rules and boundaries and laws, and as long as you can keep people corralled. And now, I will say, I've been a part of churches that some of those boundaries are much larger than others, but we all tend to put up some sort of boundary because grace just can't be that free. And so grace and truth conflict. But my question is why do they have to conflict? Because in Jesus, what I find is that grace and truth are fully embodied. If you go over to John chapter 1, about verse 14, here's what it says. It says, he was full of grace. I don't have this up here. But he was full of grace and full of truth. Now, what I find interesting about that, there's not a balance. Jesus wasn't balanced. It wasn't that he was part full of grace and part full of truth. It says he was full of both those. So here's my question. Why can't we be a church that's full of both of those things? That embodies both of those things. A place where the truth and grace, they don't have to conflict, but yet they complement. That we come to a table where we say, listen, there's a truth that God has for your life, but we're gracious enough to walk with you forever how long that takes for you to get there, for you to realize that. And again, I'm not saying we throw out truth. I'm not saying that we don't somehow improve our life both in the after and the now. What I'm saying is that at the same time, I'm not willing to discount this thing called grace that we're going to talk about today. Guys, it's not about getting yourself cleaned up, then you can come and get to know Christ. It's about the more you get to know Christ, the easier it is going to be, and the more appealing it is going to be, and the more beneficial it is going to be for you to get your stuff cleaned up. See, we reverse that. Guys, I remember about a year ago, I met a guy in his 30s, ended up baptizing him, who said the same thing. He said, I've never been told that I could just come and get to know Jesus, then begin to work on my stuff. I put getting to know Christ off for years because I thought I had to get to know my stuff before I got to know Jesus. And I said, that's just not the story. That's just not the way I read it. It's grace and truth connected to create a space of belonging. Now, let's get into Acts 15 quickly this morning. Here's the story. The church has been in existence for about 20 years. We have this place called the Jerusalem Council. All that really means, this is kind of the church's first business meeting. Okay, so they've kind of gathered together because there's been a little bit of uproar. It's about 50 AD, somewhere in there. So here we go, verse 1. I'll throw this on the screen. It said, certain people came down from Judea to Antioch and were teaching the believers. Now, they're teaching these new converts, these people that just have got to know Jesus in the last few months, years, days. Here's what they're teaching them. That unless you are circumcised according to the custom taught by Moses, that's the old law, the Old Testament, you cannot be saved. Now, if you're a church person, I don't know where you come from, but I'm guessing you didn't have to go through that in new members class. So probably whatever hoops you had to jump through probably wouldn't be that bad. I'm going to guess that the new members classes was full of women and children. Dad sitting in the car saying, listen, salvation by surgery, that ain't happening. So you can understand why this is a big issue. But the issue is really not about circumcision. It's about what? Who's in? Who's in? Who's out? And what do you have to do in order to be in or be out? Look at verse 2. So this brought Paul, that's the guy we just talked about that used to be a persecutor, and his buddy Barnabas, brought them into sharp dispute and debate with them. So they walk in and say, listen, we got to talk about some things. So Paul and Barnabas were appointed, along with some other believers, to go up to Jerusalem and see the apostles and elders about this question. They were kind of sent up there to sort this out. Listen, you got to go up there and deal with this, because it's wreaking havoc on who's in, who's out. So we got to kind of deal with this. So Paul has been teaching it's simple. Salvation's easy. Salvation comes through faith in Jesus. And as if you believe in him as the Christ, the Son, and he rose from the dead, and you know, and you give your life over, and you somehow, you know, begin to cultivate that in your own life, that's it. It's come on. So they said, okay, you got to go up there and deal with this, Paul. You're the one running around telling all the people this. So run up there. So verse 3. The church sent them on their way, and as they traveled through Phoenicia and Samaria, they told how the Gentiles had been converted, and the news made the believers very glad. So they're like, well, that's good, but. All these new converts, all these new believers, we've got to talk about something. So when they came to Jerusalem, they were welcomed by the church and the apostles and the elders, to whom they had reported everything God had done through them. Then some of the believers who belonged to the party of the Pharisees, if you don't know anything about Pharisees, these are religious people that, under the Jewish system, that had kind of given their life to knowing the law. They knew everything about the law. They were really kind of over the top, radical about it. They were the ones that would, you know, watch down to the footsteps that you would take on the Sabbath, and they were just kind of overthinkers when it came to the law. So they come in, they enter in the picture, and one of them stood up and said, well, the Gentiles, these are people outside of the Jews. That's us, most of us anyway. The Gentiles must be circumcised and required to keep the law of Moses. And then the elders met to consider this question. Here's the thing. What they're asking people to do is this. There's about 613 laws plus customs, things that kind of weren't law, but things, they're traditions, things that people did. And so it would require then the Gentiles not to just believe in Jesus. It would require a complete change of lifestyle. It would require what they eat to change. It would require how they dress to change. It would require the holidays that, you know, that they took, and the travel schedule that they would go and visit family for various holidays. All of that suddenly would change. They were asking for an identity change that had more to do with than just their identity in Christ. They were asking that, you know what, you got to become a Jew. And so the Pharisees, by the way, who had Jesus killed just a few years ago, Jesus does this thing where he rises from the grave, and they go, oh, well, I guess in that case, we're in. So now they have become believers in Jesus, but they carry kind of this old way of thinking, this narrow-minded thinking, into this new system, this system that Jesus says would free you. Now, all of a sudden, they kind of carry some of those things into it. And guys, doesn't this creep in all of our lives in some way? I was thinking about this last week, and I was reminded of a story. Family reunion, and there's crazy things that happen at family reunions. If you've been to one lately, you know what I'm talking about. But I was at a family reunion a while back, and it was on my mom's side, and so like her sisters were there. And my cousin had started dating a guy and was engaged and was about to be married. And I remember overhearing a conversation between my mom and her sisters, and some of them were like, I just don't know. Have you seen his tattoos? You know, you think that, I wonder if she's seen them, because if she did, there's no way she'd be attracted, you know. And then this was the kicker. One of my sisters says to mom, she says, you know, I just wish she could find a guy more like Jason. And my mom says, well, you know, he's got 4 tattoos. And they're like, oh. But doesn't that kind of creep in? It's not intentional, is it? But we find ourselves, and we're going to talk about this near the end, but we kind of find ourselves categorizing people, and we kind of put people in boxes. And anyway, this is what's happening. These Pharisees are coming in saying, I'm happy for her, but they got tattoos, you know? And so this is kind of what's going on. Verse 7 and 8, let's see what happens here. After much discussion, so they're discussing this thing, Peter gets up to address them. Here's what he says. Brothers, you know that some time ago, God made a choice. I love what he does right off the bat. He says, you're not in control of this. God did the choosing. There's really nothing for us to decide. That's what he's saying. But look what he says. He says, God made a choice that the Gentiles might hear from my lips the message of the gospel about Jesus and believe. Verse 8, God, who knows the heart, showed that he accepted them by giving to them the Holy Spirit just as he did to us. Here's what he says. God knows the heart. We know behavior. See, we are experts in behavior, aren't we? But he reminds us that, you know what? Just because someone behaves a certain way doesn't always mean that their heart is bad. It doesn't always mean that they're not seeking some sort of change. We know behavior. And we go, well, you know, they'll never change. I've known them for, you know, 13 years. You wouldn't believe what comes out of his mouth. You wouldn't believe the way he acts at work. Ah, there's just no hope. I just don't think of it. And we know behavior, right? And Paul says, listen, or Peter says, let me tell you, let me remind you of something, that when you begin to look at their behavior and it doesn't match up the way you think it should, that remember that God knows the heart and that God made a choice for those people. Now, look at this, verse 9. He did not, continue on, he did not discriminate between us and them, for he purified their hearts by faith. And this is the point when I think somebody stands up and goes, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. I'm down with them coming in and being a part of worship service, but you've taken it to a whole other level now, Peter. You're telling me they're purified? That God has somehow purified? Have you seen the way they act and the way they dress and what they eat? What do you mean purified? Not only do they get to come in, but they've purified? You mean to tell me that they have been purified before they've dropped their bad habits? Peter, do you realize how offensive some of their stuff is? You're telling me that they're purified before they deal with some of that offensive behavior? Are you telling me that? And Peter says, yep, that's what I'm telling you. Now, for those of you who aren't church people, and you say, you know what, church is a bunch of hypocrites, you're going to love this next verse. Look at verse 10. Peter says, now then, why do you try to test God by putting on the necks of the Gentiles a yoke? What he's talking about is the burden of this law. He says, a yoke that neither we nor your ancestors have been able to bear. Here's what he says. You Jews, you Pharisees, you teachers of the law, which, by the way, you know, you're pretty good at. You've got them all memorized and you try to keep them. He says, you can't even do it well. Your dad didn't do it well. I knew your dad. And he wasn't as good as you think he was. I knew your grandma. She wasn't as good as you think she was. He says, you can't even keep the law very well. So why in the world would you then tie that to somebody else? If you can't do it well, what makes you think these people who didn't grow up in it, didn't know anything about it, what makes you think they're going to do well with it? He says, so why don't we just start over? Why don't we just hit the reset button? You know, Jesus says something about this too, doesn't he? He says, why is it that you point out the log in somebody else's eye when you're not dealing with the speck in yours? That's what Jesus was talking about. You focus on what it is you need to be doing and how you need to be improved. And when we get into community and relationship, we'll hold each other accountable and encourage and those kinds of things. But here's what's going on. Then look at verse 11. This is the good stuff. Verse 11. No. He says, that's not what we're going to do. He said, we believe that it is through the grace of our Lord Jesus, who was embodied fully with grace and truth, that we were saved just as we are. Or they are. Guys, that's the gospel. That's the message of the church. Here's what he says. God made a choice. Didn't discriminate. And he has decided to do this. This is what God has decided to do through Jesus. That he is going to begin, and we then get to participate in this. We're going to become distributors of unmerited, undeserved salvation. We're going to walk into communities and into our workplaces and say, listen, you can't merit it. You can't deserve it. It's just something that God has kind of done. He says, I'm going to show you unmerited, undeserved favor. I'm going to call it salvation. It's going to require you to kind of surrender your life to Jesus. And here's Peter's point. If you don't take anything else home today, take this home. Peter's point is this. God can purify your heart before you can purify your actions. God can purify your heart before you fully and completely purify your behavior. Guys, and if he can do that for these people, if he can do that for me, because I'm going to tell you, there's things in my life that I look and go, wow, I got some purifying to do, but I know that I've been purified through my relationship with Jesus. If he can do that for us, then he can do that for people around us. See, this is where grace, it's in verse 11 where you begin to see grace and truth not compete, but it's where they collide and explode. And they begin to reach out into some things. Then verse 13, I don't have it up, but 13, James, who's the brother of Jesus, stands up and he says, I got something to say too. And here's what he says. Look at verse 19. He says, this is my judgment. I've sat here and I've listened to all this. And as the brother of Jesus, I get to speak. He says, here's my judgment. He says, I think we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. See, James says, listen, this is messy. I know this is hard. Listen, I'm born and raised a Jew. But he said, my judgment in this, after walking with Jesus for several years, the same way that some of you guys did, my conclusion is this: stop making it difficult for people to get to know God. Stop making it difficult because people may not do it exactly like you. See, James understands something that we miss. Look what he says. He says, stop making it difficult for those Gentiles who are, what's the word? Turning. See, what James understands is that turning, guys, it's a process. Can I tell you from the guy who leads you, I'm still turning. I'm still turning. And you are going to spend time still turning. I will never, as your leader, be fully turned. So James has said, listen, we've got to allow some grace in order to be able to present the truth that turns people. So let's stop making it difficult. Here's what he says. He says that anything you're doing that makes it difficult on the turning process is not just, it's just not in God's will. It's not what my brother had in design. He says the church is a place for everyone. And if you're seeking the possibility of change, then you've got to be able to sit there and process this in a way that allows you to turn. And then it ends, verse 20. I'm not going to read it, but here's what it says. It says, let's have a compromise in this culture, in the culture that we're talking about. He says, try not to offend the Jews. You Gentiles, try not to offend the Jews. Listen, they got a weird thing with meat. So if you invite them over to dinner, you know, mid-rare steak's probably just not going to cut it. Now, I like a good mid-rare steak. They don't. You know, so don't do that. And by the way, stop having sex with everybody. So abstain from sexual immorality, that's it. And somebody goes, well, how about, that's it. This is the compromise. Stop eating stuff that grosses them out and stop doing things that is just wrong outside of marriage and is disturbing you in some other way. Just stop, that's it. Well, that's it. Anything else is just an obstacle right now. So stop, we'll get there, but let's move on from now. Guys, that's not natural. What we've talked about this morning is just, it's just not natural. We like what's comfortable and we like what's manageable. We like to be able to manage in front of us. I'll tell you what taught me that you can't always manage. We were on the Ocoee a while back. If anybody has kind of whitewater rafted the Ocoee, you know that water, when it gets moving at a certain rate, doesn't care how heavy you are. It doesn't care if you're a man or a woman. It doesn't care black or white. It's just going to do what it wants to do, and it's going to take you where it wants to take you. And so I remember him telling us that if you jump out, then you've got to swim as hard as you can against the current in order to buy time for us to kind of get you. He said, don't swim with the current because that's going to speed up the process of you going farther and farther away. So I remember dumping out at one point, and all I remember was swim towards the current. You know, and so I found the current, you know, and I'm swimming, I'm fighting against the natural drift. And what the guide said, too, is that you can't just not do anything. He said, if you do anything, it's just you're going to drift where you want to. And so I was drawn to that and said, you know, in 2015, we did a really good job swimming against the current, saying, listen, we want to create space and environments. And in 2016, I want us to continue to create those same kinds of spaces. I want us to continue to swim against the current. And I just think that as we end this, as I land this, I want to give you a couple things that we got to continue to do very quickly. I think in order to do this, we got to avoid drifting from insider. I think we got to avoid drifting toward it and away from. Here's what I'm saying. It's a big fancy way of saying don't clump up. The Jews like to clump up. We like to clump up. don't clump up. So how do we do this? We got to be intentional. We got to continue to look around and go, hey, I don't remember you being a part of my clump. And so can I introduce you to some people in my clump? But we can't clump up. And I'm not telling you not to have meaningful relationships with people who are inside, like house groups and other things that we've designed. But there are going to have to be some sort of space that in your mind you leave open for unclumped people. I think in order to go against this natural drift that's going to happen, we've got to avoid drifting toward law and away from grace. And guys, I'm not talking theologically. There's a big church word for you. I'm not talking about, again, this throwing out truth for the sake of. I'm talking about practical. I'm talking about the way that we treat people. I think we've got to get rid of policies and category thinking. Jews and Gentiles, see, those are categories, right? That's the message of Peter and James. Stop creating categories. There's not an us and them. And the Jews are saying, well, let us know when you fulfilled all the policies, and then you can change categories. We've got to get rid of that. I think of Jesus when he called Matthew a tax collector. See, that's a category, right? And he says, well, why don't you just come with me? Well, he hasn't stopped being a tax collector. He hasn't done the policy. And so we just got to do that. I guess what I'm getting at is we just got to create fewer policies, fewer categories, and more conversation. Guys, and that's, again, that's messy. See, policies and categories, those are easy. See, I can evaluate you, put you in a category, give you the policies in order for you to change the category, and then I can step away and I don't have to do anything with you. And so it's your choice now. See, conversation requires me to get to know you. And it requires me to a level that your mess kind of becomes my mess and my mess becomes your mess. But in our messes together, we're kind of moving together. And so that's what we got to do. And then finally, one other thing that just kind of rung out to me was that we've got to avoid drifting toward preserving rather than advancing. It's going to be real easy next week to look and go, man, we did a lot. Man, we were able to do, you know, 36 families for Christmas. And man, we can categorize which we're going to do for you. And at the end of the day, the Jews, all they were trying to do was protect their God-given space, right? They were just trying to protect their past traditions. But in the process, what they did was they ignored what God was trying to do in the present. They were ignoring that. They were serving the created, that which was in front of them already put together, versus the one who was creating it. You know, I learned in 2015 in a big way this term open-handedness. Guys, I've tried to hold on to a lot of things for a long time as tight as I could, and God says, hey, why don't you just let go of some things? Why don't you participate open-handedness and let what comes in it go really quickly and watch how I begin to put other things into your hands? Stop holding on so tight. And what I've learned over the last year of leading kind of a church plant is that we take the greatest risk when we have the least chance of being successful. But it's when things begin to get rolling and all of a sudden there's something at stake, you go, well, now hold up, now I got to preserve, you know, we got something kind of good here. And we begin to take less and less and less risk. Guys, I want to tell you, I want to continue to take risk. I want to continue to go, okay, I don't know what's out there. I don't know what's on the other side of this, but I want to continue to take risk. I just want to let you know that God has not called us to preserve what he did in 2015. He's called us to continue to watch and participate with him as he creates in 2016. Guys, this is all about impacting a generation of people. It's about impacting a community. And so here's what James says. This is my judgment. Let's stop making it difficult for those who are trying to turn and get their lives in a better place and position themselves in a better place to see if change is possible. Stop making it difficult on them. So I want to continue to honestly and openly ask the question. You're going to hear me ask this from time to time. Are we making it difficult? Is what we're doing making it difficult? The way we set up, or is the mandolin making it difficult? Is this making it difficult? Is the size of our children's classroom, is that making it difficult? And you fill in your own blank, is it making it difficult for people to get to know? And if it is, you know what we're going to do? We're going to throw it out. And we're going to do something different. And you may or may not like it, but that's just what God has called us to do, is create space where people feel like they can belong. And I'm going to read this directly. I think, and by his grace, may those who are on the outside of us, through us, experience the grace and truth of Christ that has space for all of us, a place for all of us to belong. Let's pray.